We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest. So you can start with your name and your sobriety date, and then when you're ready, you can share your experience, strength, and hope. And I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Gigi, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 11th, 1986. And I am very, very grateful to have celebrated that date just less than a week ago. So that's very exciting. I am going to do the traditional open talk with what it was like and what happened and how it is now. But I did want to just lead with saying that sobriety is totally worth it, whether you've gotten it and lost it, or whether you're thinking about stopping drinking or joining a 12-step program. It is 100% worth it just to let go of that awful shame I felt when I woke up in the morning after, and then I realized what I had done the night before. The first day I didn't drink, it was so wonderful to wake up and not have that shame and guilt. It's an amazing way to feel useful and guided and directed in our lives toward our biggest dreams. You know, you don't hear many people give open talks where there aren't some quite amazing miracles that have happened in their lives. And the other thing is the healthy friends and relationships that I have. You know, they're not those fake surface friendships, quote unquote, that I had at the bar, you know, and they're not men where there's a whole agenda thing going on, you know. It's just people being exactly who they are. And I think I'll talk more about grabbing onto this higher power thing because that is a stumbling block for some people. But for me, I think about it as a power greater than my fears. And I had so many fears. And I first felt that there was some kind of a power, just the spirit in the rooms when I would go into a meeting. I would feel something there. And as the women shared and as they spoke with me and I spoke with them, I could feel that there was something that was working in this room with these particular people. And they were ending up pretty darn happy, you know. So I thought, well, maybe I'll try this. So how did I get to that point where I walked into my first meeting? Well, of course, like many of us, I grew up in an alcoholic home. I bet a lot of you listening also did. Sometimes it's not just alcoholism. There could have been some other dysfunction in the home, a variety of things, mental illness, a child that's problematic, or single-parent home, parent exhausted, struggling. So many things kind of leave us with that sense that I'm not worth anyone's time, even though that probably wasn't the intent of the adults who were taking care of us. I didn't really drink much in high school, but I did the first time I had a drink, and it was whiskey. I remember it because I was with my friends, and I'd always been kind of quiet. And of course, the biggest thing I wanted in high school was to be popular, you know. So there was a party, pool party, and we found the whiskey in the back, you know, and I drank some of it. And the next thing I knew, I had my arms around the porcelain throne, being violently ill. So I discovered that when I drank, you know, especially booze, I really did get sick. But what I also discovered was my friends. Oh, you were so much fun. You were so cool. You were jumping off the high dive. And boy, was that ever a motivator to keep, you know, getting high and so on. But the problem was I got terrible hangovers. So I really didn't drink that much in high school. When I got to college, I was kind of straight, actually. And it wasn't until later in college where my boyfriend, you know, was involved with a fraternity. And my boyfriend was in that fraternity, but he had left and gone to be in the Air Force. So I went to the fraternity's Polynesian party, and they had this great spiked rum punch. And I drank it and drank it. And before I knew it, I was going home, well, actually to a hotel room with my boyfriend's fraternity brother, even though my boyfriend was out of town. The next day, I had no idea how that had happened. And it was the first kind of red flag that, that was not good. I started out, you know, that was about the only time in college. I got married right out of college. That's a long story. I've been married three times, and now I'm happily married the fourth time, and my husband and I just had our 30-year anniversary. So one of the symptoms of my alcoholism was that fantasy that I was going to, you know, marry the knight in shining armor and be happy ever after. And I kept trying and trying, and it didn't work, and it didn't work. The first marriage ended after about, I don't know, 3 years. And I wasn't drinking then, but I discovered marijuana. And when I went to my cousin's home, he had a lot of that. So I was able to soothe the pain of my broken dreams that marriage was going to be perfect and wonderful, and that I was going to be this fantastic stepmother, which I only found out I was going to be a stepmother after we married. And that marijuana just took away that emotional pain. And that's when I really decided, oh, this is fabulous. So it wasn't until after that first marriage that I really started drinking a lot and using a lot of drugs and alcohol, men and so on. So after divorce number one, I met another guy. He worked for IBM, and we started traveling together. And pretty soon we thought it would be better to travel together if our marriage was on paper, legal, because then we could, you know, go to a Catholic country. We went to Brazil and so on where he worked. So anyway, we were together 4 years, and it was very interesting because I definitely found marijuana wherever I was. I drank beer and wine a lot, but I always got hangovers. And then during that time, there were a few incidents, like going to the military party and having too many drinks and my husband right there and me hanging all over the general, you know, and being deathly ill the next day. So that was another, you know, little signal. That we dissolved that marriage, went to grad school, couldn't believe I was there in this fancy university with all these smart people pursuing an advanced degree. And how did I get through that advanced degree? By going to the bar every night and by getting high every night, smoking dope, just to deal with the stress. So who did I meet in the bar but another guy? Now, this one I didn't marry, but lived with him during grad school. And he was a high-functioning alcoholic, and I became that too. And so those 4 years was pretty seedy kind of a lifestyle. But at the end, I didn't marry him. At the end of that, I met a man who wasn't way older than I was, which the other guys had been. And he was a counselor. He seemed to have his act together. And so we got together and got married shortly after that. And I moved to Michigan. Well, this man did know about the disease of alcoholism. Turns out he was going to Al-Anon. And here was the big red flag. Within 9 months of marrying him, he traveled quite a bit. I was going out to bars and picking up men and finding marijuana. So I thought, okay, there's something wrong with this picture. And I got my ass to a psychologist. And I said, you know, help. And he said, well, you're in the early stages of alcoholism. And I said, really? That can't be too bad. And he said, well, it's only going to get worse. And he suggested that I have two drinks, no more, no less, and see what happened. So I did that experiment, and I found that sometimes I could have two drinks and not pick up a man in the bar. I would just have two drinks and be a social drinker. Other times I'd have two drinks, a third drink, the fourth drink, go find drugs, get them in, da-da-da-da. And here's what I discovered after 6 months was I could not predict when I would be a social drinker or when I would drink alcoholically. So I had to conclude that I needed to absolutely stop and find a way to do that. So he suggested that I go to AA, and I did. And I kept working with that psychologist. I was still in the third marriage. And so, you know, for some reason, I went to my first meeting and I could totally relate. Even though, you know, there were the high bottom, low bottom drugs, da, 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 I could relate because I knew my life had been just as messy, at least emotionally, for me. And so I went to meetings, but I didn't get a sponsor. It took me about 6 months to get a sponsor, but I did start going to maybe two or three meetings a week, which was, you know, pretty good for me. That was the first 6 months. After 6 months, I got a sponsor. I started going about six times a week to meetings. And then I really realized that I wanted what these people had, and I was so grateful to have a sponsor. It took me forever to think that someone would take the time for me like that. But then we started working the steps. And just two things to know about the steps. For me, the purpose of them, my best benefit was that I discovered that I am not a piece of shit. Even though my behavior was embarrassing to me and made me feel awful about myself, that behavior didn't come from my best self. That was based on old patterns and old conditioning. And the truth was, eventually I learned that my essence, the truth of me, is good. And what had happened was that the all the lies I was telling myself, the dishonesty, the sleeping around, clogged up that channel of goodness that my higher power was trying to stream into me. And I was just all clogged up in there and couldn't really receive love. And because I was so clogged up, I couldn't really give love or be successful in a loving relationship. So I was all messed up. The steps, in my case, I found flowed love into me through doing the steps and dissolved those clogged up pipes, the channel of my life, so that I could receive and give love. If you're afraid, like I was, that doing the steps is going to be like ripping off the Band-Aid and all the stuff from the past is going to come gushing out and overwhelm you, that was my fear, that absolutely was not my case. It's kind of like my higher power, and we'll talk about that in steps two and three, but there is something bigger than my fear and my illness that directs my healing. And my experience was that my first, fourth, and fifth, and sixth, and seventh steps, where I did my inventory and looked at my defects, I only discovered the layer that I was capable of handling. There were other layers that I was to discover later, but I didn't have to discover them until I was spiritually and emotionally ready. So that was a relief to me. You know, people could have told me that in the beginning, but later I realized it, and I tell it to my sponsees, don't worry that everything's going to come out all at once, because it won't. It'll come out in manageable layers. So when I got into the steps, and we start on, you know, step one, I clearly qualified, but on step two, you know, what is this higher powered thing? Well, it just says, you know, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me. So it's kind of just saying there's a possibility that whatever's going on in these rooms, there's some power, something that is really working for these people and helping them not make crazy decisions and mess up their lives. So, you know, that was enough for me, as long as they didn't ask me to buy it lock, stock, and barrel. And same with the third step, that a power that I came to believe, well, I'm sorry, the third step where I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, I was afraid that I was going to have no choice. If I was going to let go of my free will, and that what they were talking about in that third step was just going to smother me and not be anything helpful at all. But what I found in the third step, it's really, I was not a person who had gone to I had tried to go to church and become a Christian two or three times, but I never could quite buy the entire dogma. And of course, I was drinking and using and fooling around with sex, so I didn't want to let go of any of that. When I got in the program and I got a sponsor, and we talked about the third step, and she convinced me that the only thing I needed to do there, I wasn't going to be turned into a slave. I just needed to trust that there was a care of a higher power that was going to take care of me and guide me in a good, orderly direction. And when we said that third step prayer together, it was really the first prayer I ever said that I meant 100% and that worked 100%. And that, especially the middle part where it says, relieve me of the bondage of self. That's my craziness, my selfishness, my disease, my negative thinking. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. So I'm cleaning up my life so I can be of service to God and other people. At first, I thought that third step prayer said, relieve me of the bondage of self so I can feel better, right? Because we're so self-centered at the beginning, that's all I want. You know, I'll do the steps and I'll feel better, right? And we do to some extent because we're not grossing ourselves out. But really, the healing comes when we embark on the fourth step, where we're saying, yes, I'm going to be taken care of. And I'm willing to be healed of these negative thoughts and the old scars and the character defects and the shortcomings. I'm willing to heal those so that I can be a greater force of love in the world. So the fourth and fifth steps, the inventory, you certainly know that, you know, we're looking at our lives. It isn't that there's only one chance. In my first one, really, the only thing I could look at was how many men I had slept with and how guilty and ashamed of myself I felt. And, you know, that was enough to work with, because the character defect of promiscuity, thinking that my worth was established by a man, the character defect of thinking I had to be perfect to be loved, that I couldn't handle life on life's terms, I had to escape into booze and sex. All those things, especially the self-loathing, that the self-condemnation, you know, blaming myself for what a mess my life was, that really wasn't helpful. So the very first layer was just looking at those things. And in my first fourth step, as a result of getting through the sixth and the seventh, my main practice was to give myself positive affirmations. You know, my worth is established by God. I'm lovable. People like me, because I had to reverse that negative programming that had come from my early years. Well, the second time I got around to doing a fourth and fifth step, a few years later, I was still in therapy. Oh, by the way, the third husband, after 1 year of couples counseling and so on, we separated. Then I didn't have any relationships for quite a while I got my act together. And then we did divorce the third husband. So the second, fourth step was about dysfunctional family and how awful I had felt as the youngest child in an alcoholic home and the conclusions that I drew. And if you've ever looked at those, you know, adult children of alcoholics lists of characteristics, I ticked all the boxes. And I was perfectionistic, I was codependent, I was people-pleasing, you know, all those things. And so I got to work on those things in my next fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. Of course, I was making amends to the people I had harmed, and I had them on my eight-step list. But only after working with my sponsor all the way through 4, 5, 6, and 7 and putting the people on the list. I didn't make any amends until I talked and prayed with my sponsor about it first. And I was led by my higher power to do each and every one of those that was essential at just the right time. So that's how the layers work. There's healing of different layers with the steps. And it's the job of my higher power and my sponsor to guide me, and my job is to, and I do five things to maintain my sobriety. I go to meetings. I still, after this many years, I still go to a lot of meetings. I work the steps with a sponsor. I meet and talk with my sponsor every 2 weeks, and we talk about what selfishness might have crept in, or dishonesty, or negative thinking, and we work those things through. So I work through the steps with my sponsor. In the beginning, in addition to steps and eventually finding a sponsor and starting the steps and going to meetings, there's reading the literature, because reading the big book and the 12 and 12 are really essential. And so those are three things. Then there's praying and meditating, which I do every day, and I do service work. So the way I keep my program running is to go to meetings, to work the steps with my sponsor, read the literature, pray and meditate, and do service work. And the service work is the icing on the cake. But step 10, of course, is continuing to take the inventory and continuing to look at where we're being selfish and self-serving and afraid and negative and jumping on those things right away, correcting things in our own minds and correcting things in our relationships. 11 is my favorite step because that's where I'm connecting with my higher power. I use guided meditations a lot, Insight Timer, because my mind is very busy. but reading those little daily meditation books and then just getting quiet. And eventually we do get so that we start intuitively receiving little, for lack of a better word, messages, guidance, inspiration. And that those are little things from God. Or we'll hear them coming out of the mouths of people, because I like to think of my friends as being God wearing skin. And they, the things that really come through to me and bingo, you know, that aha, I'm pretty sure that they were inspired to say that because I needed to hear it. So the 11th step, of course, praying is essential. I pray every day. I've memorized the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer. I say them every day. The serenity prayer, I've memorized a whole bunch of other ones that help me calm my thinking. And then, of course, the 12th step is practicing this in all our affairs. I had to practice these principles quite rigorously in my work life because I became kind of professionally competitive and a workaholic, and so I had to really go back and work through the steps just on that issue. But certainly the spiritual awakening that's referred to in the 12th step is the icing on the cake. And it really does take going through the steps with a sponsor, getting through step 9 before those promises start coming true, where we really do start being of service and able to give and receive love and care. Helping others is, of course, one of my favorite parts. I'm doing that right now, and so does Tara. It's, you know, that's another thing. It's almost like our higher power is up there saying, oh, that person will be really good with this person, and putting us together in the most amazing ways, whether it's in the rooms or outside of the rooms. We tend to meet people, just the right people, saying just the right thing that we need at any given time. And that is a wonderful part of that continual spiritual progress. I've ventured out to other spiritual teachings, because in the 11th step, it encourages us to find spiritual programs, teachings, religions, etc. And so I do some things that are Buddhist. I do some energy work things. I do some course in miracles. I go to a church occasionally. So it's wonderful to be guided to additional resources for spiritual growth. There's so many wonderful books and teachers out there, and I've been blessed with their teachings. So now my life is very, very happy, and I have 34 years clean and sober, and I really wouldn't change one thing about my journey. My higher power must have known that I was a person who needed a man, because after all those failed relationships, I met Peter, my current husband, my fourth husband, at a meeting, and took a long time to get to know him, and we finally, after 2.5 years, married, and we just had our 30-year anniversary, and I'm very, very, very grateful for that, and for the wonderful friends I have in recovery. It's just a wonderful life I have now, and it's by the grace of God. And I'll conclude with that.
Well, happy birthday. Happy birthday. That's wonderful.
Thank you. Been a wild ride.
And 30 years of marriage is also worthy of a congratulations and happy anniversary whenever that happened. So 30 years was in 2019.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's wonderful. So I really enjoyed how you broke down the steps, and I really enjoyed kind of the 5 things you do to maintain probably not just your sobriety, but your serenity. Mm-hmm. And I will come back to some of those. Step 11 is my favorite as well. And I'm super excited to have our off recording chat, because I want to talk more about your energy work and Course in Miracles and whatnot. But in terms of your story, backing up from the beginning, that awful shame and guilt in the morning that you mentioned, I didn't track how many years you were actually out there drinking. So you certainly experienced what a lot of us have experienced, that waking up and I did it again. And what am I going to do now? How long were you out there?
Yeah, the escalated part where I was still functioning, but really messed up emotionally, probably about 10 years, I would say. Yeah.
I love hearing how everyone gets into the rooms in different ways. That's probably my favorite part of every story, because it's always a little bit different. And for you, it was through a psychologist.
Yep.
And when you came into the rooms, you talked about people being exactly who they are. Have you found, in 34 years of sobriety, any other situation where people are exactly who they are, comfortably, honest, happy, forthcoming?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it is only found in the rooms of in 12-step rooms. However, it is most reliably found in 12-step rooms. I have found a very similar sense in the Unity Church. It's not Unitarian Church, it's Unity. And their teachings are very consistent with 12-step programs. And Marianne Williamson, who has been a candidate but wrote A Return to Love, the bestseller, was a Unity minister in Detroit, where I went to church. By the way, if anyone is interested in learning about what's called A Course in Miracles, which is a system for overcoming negative thinking and connecting with a higher power, her book is the bestseller about it, and it's called A Return to Love. And it's a wonderful introduction.
Wonderful.
And I should mention Karen Casey, C-A-S-E-Y, is also written several books. She wrote the very first women's 12-step daily meditation book called Each Day a New Beginning, published by Hazelden. And that was my very first meditation book. She also has written about the Course in Miracles very wonderfully. Yeah, it's a little like energy work in the sense that you do it and you're not sure what it's cognitively changing. It's like the practice itself helps our thinking. But the few essential elements, and maybe now is a good time to mention my book, because I was inspired in 2011 to write a book where I had such a wonderful healing in my life, especially with my family. And I was feeling so grateful. And I thought, what if I could put some of this program stuff, along with all the other tools I've learned, into a book that would help people overcome negative thinking and worry and make a self-help book? So I just published it in 2018. And it's available in an audio and ebook too. And I entitled it 50 Ways to Worry Less Now. And then it says, reject negative thinking to find peace, clarity, and connection. But the book contains all the different tools and spiritual paths. It's small, really. It's only 160 pages, but I packed in there. It's my story with the tools that I learned that helped me overcome the problems I was having. And then it explains how to use the tool and where to find more resources. So one of those tools is A Course in Miracles. And it gives a little thumbnail description of the fact that the only purpose of it is to identify our negative thinking or our non-spiritual thinking and turn toward our spiritual nature and our positive, loving thinking. That is the only purpose of A Course. The miracle is when we take a negative and turn it into a loving thought. So I read the book in a study group, which is very helpful. But I suggest to people A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson and Karen Casey's books, because they're so much simpler and they contain the essence. Or read the book, the Course in Miracles book, Daily Lessons, and just do those and read the text in a study group. Anyway, enough about that. When the shit hits the fan in life, regardless of what it is, when we're sticking close to the program, the first thing I do is I increase any or all of those five things, either the meetings, meeting with my sponsor, praying and meditating, reading literature, or the service. I up my footwork because I have to fill up my sanity bank because I'm, you know, in what feels like an insane situation. And as we fill up the sanity bank with all that footwork, new resources come to us. So I discovered radical forgiveness, which is a guy ran across a parking lot to tell me about it, and it turned out to be the perfect tool. I was in a mastermind group already because I had started the book, and there's an explanation of how to form a mastermind group and run one according to the Unity Church version of mastermind, which is very similar to the 12 steps. It was developed by a Unity minister, Jack Boland, also from Detroit. And so that's a tool that helped. So, you know, when these things happen to us, when we're sticking close to the program, new resources come to us. And because we're scared shitless, I at least am, and I want to feel better eventually, I grab onto those tools and use them. The problem is they don't fix the situation right away. As a matter of fact, one of the best things I heard in Al-Anon was sometimes waiting is an action. You know how we're in an uncomfortable situation, we want to figure out what to do, how to act to change it so I can be comfortable again. Well, that isn't the way it works. I have to up my spiritual work, I have to up my footwork, and I have to be patient and, you know, wait for my higher power to resolve it in the best way possible. I did put a lot of stuff in there. Chapter 4 is about the law of attraction and affirmations and drawing your goodness to you and vision boards and all that, because I did that with the book and I did that with my marriage, and that really works too.
But for the alcoholic out there that still suffers, perhaps has never been in the rooms of recovery and is not sure what to do next, what do you have to say to them?
As hard as it might be to believe, the essence of who you are is not all the shit you did in your past, or what people said to you, or what happened to you, those awful things, whether you caused them or not. That stuff does not define who you are. As of today, you can make choices to have the life of your dreams, actually. And the first step is getting sober. So for those of us who've already started that road, congratulations to us. For those of you who are pondering it, I just have to say what I said at the beginning. You will not believe the wonderful things you will discover about yourself. You will heal those past wounds, and you will find that the essence of you is not that mess from the past. The essence of you is goodness. It's your God self or your higher self, your true self, and that becomes your guidepost, your compass, your way of living. That's what you turn to, and it directs you in the most amazing ways. You can totally trust it. Now, we're human beings, so we forget. And I have to say that even though I wrote a book about worry, I still worry, and I still use the tools all the time. So it's not like I'm ever going to get rid of my negative thinking or worry or fear. But I have more and more tools, and the more I fill up my sanity bank, I can pull from that center of me to get through it, even though maybe it's not happening the way I wanted to right now. That's it. When I heard a power greater than and a God word, and I was terrified, because every other time I'd try to become spiritual, you know, it just felt wrong. And I thought these people in these rooms were going to try to get money from me or control me or make me believe a certain thing like all the other groups I had been in. And I was adamantly opposed. So when they said a God of your own understanding, and then it didn't even have to be called God, God could be a placeholder name because it's in the literature, but I could fill in that blank with language that worked for me. That was a huge relief. I had a little trouble with the male aspect of a higher power, because in my third journey through the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh steps, about 5 years into sobriety, I uncovered some sexual abuse that had happened, and it was at the hands of men. And no wonder I couldn't really cozy up to a higher power that had a male identity. So when I went to Unity Church early on, some friends who showed up in just the right place at a meeting, and I was willing to go, and they had a workshop on the female deity, the female divine aspect of the early Christian years. And so really, quite often I'll say, you know, a he-she female presence. And even in that book, that wonderful book called The Shack, which I love, it's a bestseller, The Shack, the God figure is a big, loving female presence, flings open the, you know, the door and welcomes this guy in. Anyway, I think it's fine to find your higher power in the rooms, in the people, in the spirit of the rooms, until you feel like it's something else. And I don't think it has to be this big woo-woo thing that you have some bolt of lightning. Some people do, some don't. I never did. Gradually, I came to believe and trust.
Gigi, happy 34 years.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.